Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about the program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Visit our archives there and listen to any program you may have missed. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. We will repeat this info at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. And now, Jim Andrews.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. We continue our exposition currently of the small book of Habakkuk. We're in Habakkuk chapter 1 today, verses 12 through 17. As we mentioned in our opening message, other than his Old Testament book, little is known about the prophet Habakkuk, who wrote in pre-exilic times, that means before the Babylonian captivity, and the total destruction of Jerusalem, the capital of Judea, in 586 B.C. It culminated in a slaughter of a great, great many of the Jewish people there, and the surviving remnant was taken to Babylon like a herd of cattle. Like Jeremiah, with whom Habakkuk was contemporary, we think Habakkuk lived to see the awful decimation of Judah and Jerusalem that the Lord revealed to him. Habakkuk is mystified by the Lord's patience with pervasive evil and injustice that was raging in the land of Judah like a wildfire. It seemed to the prophet, from where he stood, that the Lord's silence in the face of all the outrages that the prophet sees smacks of some kind of unaccountable indifference on God's part. Yet Habakkuk knows in his heart that God is a just God, a holy God, and so he just cannot connect the dots. He has what we call cognitive dissonance. We've got square pegs here in round holes. He's mystified by God's tolerance at everything Habakkuk knows that God deplores. So his issue in this book, at least at the beginning, there is another issue that will come up here in this section, but why doesn't the Lord step up and do something to check all of this rapaciousness and injustice and strife and contention and all of that thing that fills the land? His statement was in verses 3 and 4 of the first chapter is, "Why dost thou make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention exists. Therefore, the law is ignored and Lord, justice is never upheld, for the wicked surround the righteous, and therefore justice comes out perverted." Well, his perplexity is nothing new. There are always times in every generation and culture when God's people are impatient with evil. And we can't help but wonder at times why God doesn't, if I may put it so, open fire, so to speak, on those who ignore his law, who flaunt their wicked ways and practice monstrous injustice and seem to skate by with virtual impunity. Many believers look at what is going on in our own culture, including myself. We see the brazen wickedness. We witness at times unaccountable injustice, and we see the lawless plunder of others with seeming impunity, and in certain other cases, considering the awesome magnitude of their crimes, when they get caught with their hands in the cookie jar, some of them get off with relatively light sentences or even probation. In the last couple of decades, I think one of the most outrageous miscarriages of justice was the O.J. Simpson case, where the guy The jury trial notwithstanding, everybody, I think, except the extremely prejudiced, know that the jury trial was a farce, and I think the civil trial later showed that. The guy brutally murdered two people and walked out of court a free man, though, thankfully, later some degree of justice has caught up with him. Then you think of all the corporate crooks and the Wall Street swindlers. Think of all the corrupt and morally perverse politicians who lie, who cheat, who steal. Think of those who still manage to keep their seats in legislative bodies. I mean, they're still there, in spite of all these revelations. You think of mobsters and gangbangers, of unjust and mindless judges who slap vicious predators barely on the hand. You think of mayhem and murder, of drug dealers and drug users, of fornicators and adulterers, and that's just a short list of the evils and evildoers that seem to get away with their sins and lawlessness all the time. And we can't help but wonder, Lord, will you just look the other way? So we can relate, I believe, to Habakkuk's complaint. We can also take comfort in the principle of God's answer. For the answer that the Lord gives Habakkuk is that in his own time, God, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, he will indeed answer the wicked. And when he does so, he will do it resoundingly. So in verse 2, the prophet had said, "How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you won't answer? I cry to you, violence! Lord, do something to arrest this criminal activity. And yet, thou dost not save." I want to call attention as we back up to verse 2 that one thing we do note here in Habakkuk's prayer is that this business of prayer is very often, we find as we walk with God, a marathon, and it's not a dash. In most instances, we, like Habakkuk, can forget about speed dial prayer. We usually get to heaven with our petitions, folks, a lot faster than heaven gets to us with answers. But answers delayed, understand, are not necessarily answers denied. God knows it is good for us to persevere in prayer and to learn patience in waiting for God's response. For that perseverance teaches us to wait on the Lord and His timing, and not to give up prematurely in our prayer life, for it will be necessary in the course of things for the Lord to answer our petitions when He is ready, rather than when we start pleading. His time, we learn over time, will always be the best time. So in verse 3, as I pointed out a few minutes ago, the prophet complains of rampant iniquity and wickedness, and more specifically of human destruction and violence. And the Lord tells him, "Habakkuk, I'm going to deal with it. The Babylonians are coming, and it's going to be awesome. It's going to be unbelievable when they come. Look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I'm going to do something, Habakkuk, in your days that you would not believe if you were told." In other words, it's going to be incredible. "For I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people, who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. These people are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate from themselves. Might is right in their cases." In other words, you can't expect any restraints of conscience or the authority of God Himself to put any brakes on them. "And they're going to be fast and efficient. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves. Their horsemen come galloping. They come to do business. They come from afar. They're tireless. They will fly like an eagle, swooping down to devour." Verse 9, "All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward." They're not backing up for anything. "They collect captives like sand." And they're not afraid of anybody. "Experience has taught them of the superiority of their power, so they mock at kings and rulers, are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress. Is that supposed to stop us? No way. They heap up rubble that they've created to build ramps to capture it. And then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on. Like the wind, they're here and then they're gone and then they pass into the dustbin of history. They will be held guilty, accountable, because their strength is their God. And idolatry is the ultimate sin. So in verse 12, Habakkuk, having been comforted, is still perplexed in one important respect. His confidence in the character of God remains rock solid, but his understanding of God's ways is wanting at a certain point. Habakkuk says, as he ponders God's answer, "Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? I know we will not die. Thou, O Lord, has appointed them to judge, and thou, O rock, has established them to correct. Thine eyes are too pure to approve evil," in verse 13. "And I know that you cannot look on wickedness with favor. So why dost thou look with favor on those?" Referring to the Chaldeans or the Babylonians. "Why dost thou look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why do you favor the foul," in other words? "Why art thou silent when the wicked are swallowed up by those more righteous than they?" Get that. He continues in verse 14. "Why have you made men, human beings, like the fish of the sea, like creeping things, without a ruler over them? Nobody to stand up for them. Nobody to defend them. The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, like fish in a barrel, and they drag them away with their net, and they gather them in their fishing net, and therefore the Chaldeans rejoice, and they are glad, they laugh, and go on committing murder and mayhem. And in the end, they do not acknowledge you." That's not what he says, but that's what he means. "They offer sacrifice to their net. They're just hideous idolaters, and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large, and their food is plentiful, and they don't give you a thought. Are you going to let them therefore empty their net, Lord, and continually slay the nations without sparing?" Well, let's go back and examine what Habakkuk has to say here. In verse 12, I want you to notice that he has certain firm convictions about the nature and the character of God. "Art thou not from everlasting? Aren't you an eternal being? O Lord, my God, my Holy One." There he affirms that God is a holy being. He is immortal, and he ever lives to protect his people and fulfill his promises. And he is a God who is morally pure without defect. He is firm in those convictions, and that's what's creating his problem. He knows that God will not allow the wicked to prevail over the righteous. Moreover, Habakkuk affirms that God is the rock of his people. A rock is secure, and it's a reliable foundation for a house like Israel, in a storm. You remember Jesus used that same rock foundation in Matthew 7, where he talked about a house being built upon the sand, and the storms and the winds and all the violence of the elements came, and the house erected on a sand foundation did not stand, but a house erected on God's word, on a rock, does stand, and the winds and the storms and all that kind of thing beat against it, and it remains stable. Well, the rock will not fail when it's assailed by the elements. So God is as firm and reliable as a rock. Therefore, he calls him, "O thou, O rock." It's reliable and dependable for those who trust in him, and he will keep them anchored safely. Thus, he says, "we will not die." I know, I'm convinced, we, your chosen people, will not perish. An awful storm of judgment is coming. Unprecedented. And Habakkuk sees it. The Lord has revealed it to him. But he is convinced that God's people, in the end, though many will be destroyed, the nation will not perish. He knows that God will be ever faithful to his ancient promises, even in the midst of judgment. "You are not finished with this nation. You will not allow it to be destroyed. You are my God." Yes, you are our God. That is, the people of Israel. "You're a holy God." These are his firm convictions. You're too pure to let evil get a free pass. You have promised the survival of this nation to our fathers. That's not explicit, that is implicit in what he's saying. So I know, somehow, some way, we will survive, though we will be severely savaged by the destroyer, the Chaldeans who are coming. But you are able to save us, for you're everlasting and you're ever able. You are neither dead nor are you dying. You will always be around to redeem the godly among your people. Now, I call your attention again to this fact, that those are Habakkuk's core convictions. He has a foundation of core convictions. There are things that are not adding up to him. There are things where, as I say, he cannot connect the dots. We all have those. We have those areas of mystery where we don't get it. We don't fully understand. If God is this way, then why this? If that, then how does this square with what we know about God over here? That kind of thing is not unusual. Habakkuk's just airing it all out in sincerity. But there are things that he needs to know, and he begs that God would clarify this. And what is mystifying him right now is not the fact that God is coming to judge, but what is puzzling him is the instrument of his judgment. That really is throwing him. You abhor wickedness, and yet, Lord, these Chaldeans, they rank way up there on the scale of evil human beings. He says, I know it is not your nature to look favorably upon the perverse. So why, Lord, do you look with favor in this case on those who deal so treacherously? It seems totally out of character with you. I don't understand. I do understand. That is implicit down here in verse 12. Thou, O Lord, has appointed them to judge, and thou, O rock, has established them to correct. This I get, he says. You need to judge this nation. That's where we started, Habakkuk says. And even we who are godly, we need to be corrected. You're sending them to correct. All of us, we learned this from Hebrews chapter 12, all of us believers needed the barnacles knocked off our hull. We all need to be cleansed and we need to be purified. We may be people with hearts after God, but we're still in this flesh. We've still got some of the crud of sin in our lives, and you're sending these people not only to judge, to punish, to kill, and to destroy the godless among us, but you're sending them to have the effect of correcting and purifying those among your people. We have our rough edges, and so even the righteous need their character burnished like weathered brass. It's who you're sending to do it that is troubling me. So, Lord, if you and your holy character, if you're a God who doesn't approve evil, if you don't give evil your blessing, if you don't countenance with favor the treacherous, and that's what these people are and worse, how can you let these felons loose on us? For Lord, it seems to me, Habakkuk is saying, here is clearly a case where the cure is worse than the disease. You're using the worse to punish the merely bad. It seems to me like you're bringing in a monster just to kill a snake. I don't get it. Habakkuk is saying, to distill and crystallize the issue that he's dealing with even more forcefully, if my people, he's saying, are a can of worms, these Chaldeans that you're bringing in for judgment to punish us, they're a can of snakes. On the face of it, it seems that you've declared open season on the human population through these Babylonians. So his problem is one that you and I would have keenly felt perhaps in World War II if God had let the Japanese and Germans overthrow the Allies. For as bad as we were, they were worse. Or if God would allow atheistic communist countries to have overrun America. Or, as degenerate as the West is today, including our own country, we'd have the same problem, perhaps, if the Lord were to allow radical Islam to take us down. Oh, Lord, we might think, we do deserve judgment. We've been saying that. But these people that you're using as your executioners are monsters of another order. So how can you let them be your instruments of destruction when they deserve judgment more than almost anybody on earth? So Habakkuk ponders the incongruity of the situation coming upon them. Here are the horrible Chaldeans turned loose like junkyard dogs on the nations, including Judah. And we are all just like fish in a barrel. These predatory people catch nations too weak to defend themselves on their vicious hooks, and they haul them away, squirmingly helpless, in their cruel nets. They are idolaters to the max. That's terrible. They virtually redefine the term. They give no thought or recognition, whatever, to you, the true and living God. Are you going to let them empty their nets and enrich themselves at the expense of others and continually destroy victim nations without impunity? Lord, I'm in a state of consternation. Please help me with this. Well, here's what we can learn from Habakkuk's plight in this deal. Let me go over a few points that are very practical and are timeless. Folks, God's ways are not our ways, and His thoughts are not our thoughts. That's Isaiah 55. Thus, my friends, in walking with God, we must have a low threshold for mystery. That is a big point in my book, Polishing God's Monuments. Though God will never act out of His revealed character, here's the deal. At times, and this is one, He may seem to. We must learn to expect that. Two, it is one of the first laws of a sound faith to give the Lord God the benefit of doubt. You see, our knowledge, mine, yours, everybody's, even those of us who truly know God, our knowledge of God is still too limited. Our comprehension of God's being is too small to get the complete picture. We must let God be God and figure a lot of these things out, these mysteries out, later. Three, what offends God is not when we seek understanding, as Habakkuk does, in cases where we can't fit the puzzle together, but it's when we arrogantly assume too much understanding and we rebel against His ways of doing things. You know, we don't fault little kids from asking natural questions. But if we are parents, we do fault rebellious teenagers who presumptuously challenge our parental wisdom in an all-knowing way. Habakkuk did not do that. Fourthly, Habakkuk did the right thing, and so will we. If we take our perplexity to the Lord and we seek understanding of God's ways in a humble way, and we just frankly acknowledge that, Lord, on the surface, these things seem at variance with Your revealed character. You'll notice Habakkuk is not accusing the Lord of infidelity to His own self-disclosed character. He's just mystified about how the pieces can be harmonized. And just as we see in the Psalms, my friends, we can be honest with God too. And the Lord will be patient with us, and He will be compassionate. Finally, I want you to see, in Habakkuk, particularly verses 12 through 13, notice how a sound knowledge of God and confidence in His revealed attributes can anchor us when some of the pieces don't seem to fit. Habakkuk possessed a rock-rib knowledge of and convictions about the Lord, and it was those convictions that kept him spiritually stable while he sought answers. You can't trust in God when you're wanting in specific knowledge of or convictions about Him. You see, we must gain a sound knowledge of God. We must be in His Word to possess an intelligent faith. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word, remember, is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about this program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at www.thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this broadcast outreach.